You're listening to 91.1 KRCB-FM Windsor and 90.9 K215-CQ Santa Rosa. A quick check of your weather tonight. Skies are going to be clear with a low of around 50 degrees. Winds will be out of the north from 7 to 17 miles an hour. For the start of your work week, highs will be around 78. Skies are going to be sunny all week with a gradual warming trend into the mid-80s. It's 8 p.m. Stay with us. Outbeat Radio is next.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. We have Dr. Margaret Gold. Yes, in studio tonight. Dr. Gold is a family doctor. I was going to say therapist because I am. Dr. Gold is a family doctor that does integrative medicine and acupuncture. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
It's so great to have you here.
Thank you.
We're really, really happy that you're here. We want to welcome you to Living Proof, and we have many, many questions to ask you. About being a doctor and a gay doctor at that, a lesbian doctor at that. But before we ask those questions, we have to have our engineer, friend, Outbeat member, Greg Moralia, give us the news and events of the week. Take it away, Greg.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of October 1st, 2017. A Brazilian judge has approved gay conversion therapy in a ruling which prompted widespread outrage and raised fears of conservative backlash. Valdemar de Carlo, a federal judge in the capital of Brazil, overruled a 1999 decision by the Federal Council of Psychology that forbids psychologists from offering widely discredited treatments which claim to cure gay people. This ruling came a week after a bank canceled an exhibition of art following protests from right-wing and evangelical Christian groups. Brazil has a growing population of evangelical Christians who have aggressively protested plot lines in television soap operas featuring gay or transgender characters and increasingly allied themselves with growing right-wing groups. David Miranda, a leftist counselor in Rio de Janeiro and one of the country's few openly gay politicians, said, quote, "This decision is a big regression in the progressive conquests that the LGBT community had in recent decades," end quote. Brazil is one of several South American countries where LGBT DACA participants here in the U.S., if deported, could be put in danger. And here in the U.S., the Associated Press reports three people have been charged with first-degree murder in the brutal slaying of a transgender teenager in Houston. Allie Steinfeld, 17, was found dead last week in a rural area near a mobile home occupied by one of the suspects. She had been stabbed repeatedly, including in her genitals, and her eyes had been gouged out, according to an Associated Press report. Her body was burned in an attempt to conceal evidence of the crime. Texas County Prosecutor Park Stevens Jr. told the Houston Herald, quote, "It is a grisly, terrible series of heinous acts by the accused." The suspects are Andrew Verba and his girlfriend Isis Shower, both 18 years old. They're charged with first-degree murder, armed criminal action, and abandonment of a corpse. And in San Francisco, the Frameline Film Festival, the largest LGBT film festival in the world, is hosting an encore presentation of The Lavender Scare, a documentary by Josh Howard about the purge of some 10,000 gay people from federal employment in the 1950s and 60s. This largely unknown part of history has been made visible through interviews and images in this amazing film. You can see it for free on Thursday, October 19th at 7 p.m. Documentarian Josh Howard will be there to answer questions. And you can listen to our interview with Josh on Outbeat News in depth. Just go to outbeatnews.com. And here locally, the third annual one-day Trans Life Community Conference happens this year on Saturday, October 21st. Parents, children, and allies of transgender and gender non-conforming individuals are welcome at this event. You can get tickets and learn more at translifeconference.org. And the Sonoma County Pride organization that plans the annual Pride celebration is looking for new board members and volunteers to work on this year's celebration, planned for June 1st through the 3rd. If you have an interest and time to give, learn more at sonomacountypride.org. For a calendar of LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. I'm Sheridan. And we're in studio this evening with Dr. Margaret Gold, and she allows us to call her Meg. So welcome, Meg. We're so happy to have you in studio tonight.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Cool. So we only gave the audience just a little bit about you. I mean, you just a vast of knowledge and wisdom. And so what else would be important for them to know as an introduction to who you are? What would be?
Well, would you like to know a little bit about my work? Would that be helpful?
Yeah, and how did you relocated here, right?
Yeah, I did. I'm a transplant. Yeah. Well, actually, I came to California 4 years ago from the East Coast. So I had been doing the whole, you know, the lesbian circuit between Western Mass and Boston and Provincetown and then back to Northampton. I mean, that's what you do when you live in Massachusetts. So, and you're an out lesbian. So, but I felt really inspired to come here. And I started in Monterey and I lived in Carmel and I had a practice there for a little while. But it was hard. The primary care there has been really having difficulty maintaining a presence, really, and there wasn't really good reimbursement for doctors there, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So I had an accountant tell me that my job was sort of like a hobby.
Oh.
And not really like an earning, didn't have any earning potential because I was doing integrative medicine and functional medicine and it was a cash practice.
Could you explain what you mean by integrative medicine for folks that might not know what that means?
Well, you know, when people come and see me, my intention is to keep them off of medication if I can. Certainly to support if they do need to stay on that and be on that. And really to look at people's lifestyle and to help them understand what they're doing to either promote or benefit themselves or harming themselves in some way or neglecting a part of themselves. So using more natural medicine like food, herbs, minerals, supplements, clean water, you know, exercise, sleep, and really promoting those kinds of things, trying to understand the biochemistry of the body and how it works from the story that I'm hearing from the person and try to understand what's really going on and then either take away or give back what the body needs.
Do you find that when people come to see you, they just want a little pill to feel better? They don't want to do all that work?
If they do, they don't stay for long.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm the one who is saying that I don't prescribe very often unless I have to, and that I expect my patients to have a rapport with me that they're interested in actually taking care of themselves. And so I'm really happy because I get a lot of people who want to be well. It's great. So here I am in Sonoma County for my first year.
Wow. Yeah. Fantastic.
I'm just surprised that Monterey and Carmel wouldn't have progressive people who would be interested in that. So, but we don't have to stay there. But
okay,
I know it was
a little hard to understand. It was a little more conservative than I thought mm-hmm. it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, continue telling us more about you, about your transplanting, about coming here into this area, and you landed in Sonoma County.
I did, and I'm in a full-time practice. I work for a large organization here, and currently, I have almost 1,500 patients in my first year, and I'm way overbooked already. So my practice is closed, but when people email me at my work and they ask me personally, I can open the door and let them in to my practice. So I have vowed to let in any gay, lesbian, identified, bisexual, transgender, queer person and family that might want to come. That's part of the Kaiser system. So that's been my commitment. And there's a limit I'll reach at probably 1,900 people. So the time is now, I guess, if anyone out there is connected.
Hurry up, y'all. Call us.
If you weren't on this radio show, how would people find out about you to know that you had that special little place in your heart to open the door for the LGBT community? How would they know?
Well, on my website, I have my own personal website attached to my work website, and so people read about it, and they're very assertive. They call me or they write to me and just ask. And it's also word of mouth, but I'm really partial to caring for this particular family.
So if somebody went to Dr. Margaret Gold on the Kaiser website, they would find your own personal website there?
And then they'd also read about my philosophy and sort of my roots.
I've seen your website. It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
And see if there's a match, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what else? Let's see. I bought a house in Santa Rosa. I live there with my chocolate Labrador, who's 18 months old now.
Grace.
You have both met. She really wanted to come tonight.
Oh.
But I thought it would be a little disturbing if she was trying to eat the microphone, so she had to stay home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how long have you been here?
Just a year.
Just a year. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of clients. That's a lot of patients.
It is.
Do most doctors have that many patients?
They actually have more.
Oh.
So, dang. Yeah. It's a little bit of a struggle with the people who decide those things, because we think we can't really provide the kind of care we want to with that number of people. So, but that's usually the norm. And people are generally disenfranchised with doctors these days, and they do a lot of blaming and exert a lot of impatience and frustration, and a lot of it is understandable. But we're working with inside of a broken system right now. So I'm actually, I don't know if I told you that I'm writing a book about this.
Oh, yeah. So say more about that.
The working title, which will probably change in my head, is the working title is Behind the Exam Room Door. Because my hope is that I can help to generate a sense of empathy and compassion inside of a medical clinic when people are waiting, or people feel that their need is more important, that is so important right now that they may not understand that there's someone in that room whose partner just died, or that a baby was born, stillborn, which has been part of my practice in the last month, or that the doctor herself may have just seen on her desk that her favorite patient is deceased. But then we take a drink of water and straighten our shoulders and go into the exam room and say, hello, how are you? How can I help you today? So I have a lot of empathy for doctors, and I think that there's something coming from about that, that maybe in the future I'll be even talking to doctors about how to allow themselves to appear more human and vulnerable. Because we're taught in training that we're not allowed to make mistakes. So there's a lot of shame in making mistakes or feeling or appearing vulnerable, which is crazy. Wouldn't you think that as someone who is really a healer should be really open-hearted and available emotionally? Right?
So where is this book coming from? Your own experience?
It is. Yes. Uh-huh. So I've been a doctor for, I think it's now 21 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I became an intern. I got out of med school and became an intern at 40. So with two children at the time who were teenagers. So that was quite a ride. Yeah.
They must have been very understanding teenagers.
they were not really understanding teenagers.
Well,
that's an oxymoron.
Well, I mean, I've been in graduate school before, but it wasn't medical school, and that took a lot of time, you know, going to class, doing your projects, doing your papers. So I can't imagine raising two children and doing that, you know, without a partner. Did you have a partner at the time, or?
No, what happened is actually, as both of them were boys, and so in their middle teen years, they each made the decision to live with their father full time. And so it was helpful in the sense that I was beginning to be on call at night, and I could see them when I was not working and not in school. It was extremely painful for me to let go so early and to be so torn. That part was, and I think it was really hard for them too. You know, I think on some level, you know, I think that any kid that has to live in two separate homes is, there's some element of really deep pain around that.
Especially when, you know, the parents, you know, sometimes parents can be cordial and like each other and work together, and sometimes they can't.
Yeah.
And so that puts the kids in the middle too. So.
Yeah, and we were not cordial. So, and my children and I, and likely their father, all suffered through two different custody battles. So that was rough.
Is it two different custody battles because you have two kids?
Or? No, it's just different years. It just happened a second time.
So the first time didn't work, and so it was tried again.
Yeah, and actually it was tried just before, weeks before I entered medical school, under the guise that that I wouldn't be able to provide for them physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, environmentally in school. And so I spent all of the money that I had saved for medical school to go to court and show them that my schedule would actually be exactly the same as theirs because I was in school and not working anymore, and that I would actually be more available. But it opened up the court to be able to ask my eldest where he wanted to be, and that's when he decided he wanted to be with his father. So that's how it went down.
Wow. Those must have been some hard times as you're starting a new chapter in your life, starting medical school, and then both kids left at the same time?
Within a couple of years.
And so the visitation, you were able to see them? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you were
isolated
from them.
But, you know, not to be having dinner with them and not to, you know, I mean, you live with kids, you know, all of a sudden I was standing at the refrigerator eating out of whatever was in there and I actually stopped cooking. I stopped cooking for a long time after that. Mm-hmm. So there were some real effects. Mm-hmm. So.
And your children are now in their.
They're old now.
20 years.
They're 40 and 41 and 37. Yeah.
41.
And they're great. And they moved to California of their own volition within the last 2 years. So I'm really happy about that. We're all here.
To be close to mom?
No.
You said that like no, like.
Well, no. I mean, I think that's probably like, you know, true. We all like each other and we'd like to be together, but, you know, for their careers and their work.
Oh, okay. You know. And you're a grandma too, right?
I am. So two little girls. So great.
What are they called?
Julia Grace.
Julia Grace.
And Diana Claire.
Diana?
Diana Claire, who will be two pretty soon and has turned into this wild, independent, beautiful, dark-haired young lady who I just adore them both. They're great.
What do they call you?
They call me Grandma.
How's that feel?
So they have three families. So you know, they have their father, their grandfather, and his wife, and then they have their other grandparents. And so when Julia was born, Robert asked me, "What do you want to be called?" And I said, "I am the grandma." And I said, "And there's only one grandma." and so the other grandmother wanted to be called by her first name. So it's worked out. I think it's worked out.
That's awesome.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So Diana is two.
And Julia is 5 and a half. Oh. Well, she's actually 5 3/4. We're really up to date on this.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really good.
So you have extended family here, even though it's Oakland and Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a great Friday night flight to L.A. Uh-huh. from Santa Rosa direct in about an hour.
Yeah.
And you can come back on Sunday afternoon.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. I'm just going to change the subject a little bit because we're going to go back and forth with you and your kids and when we learn more about you and your coming out and all of that. But I'm curious about the other parts of you that I think it'd be important for people to know. I know you're deeply into shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can go into shamanism and just talk about some of your passions, that what brought you into the medical field. And because I have the sense about you that you really care deeply about people, Meg, you know? Mm. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, part of my roots were based on the fact that I worked at the Michigan Women's Music Festival for almost 20 years in the womb, which is the healthcare area. And I started out as a volunteer and a person who came to help. And I got to witness all of these beautiful women who were empowered, who were doctors and paramedics and, you know, just really, especially the doctors, I was completely mesmerized. But, oh my goodness, that could be me. And the herbalists and these beautiful witches who were like completely all about, knew all these plant medicine. And nothing was done conventionally there, really. I mean, if you had to have something conventional, they had a machine. If you had asthma, you could have a nebulizer treatment. But there weren't stethoscopes and things. There were just herbs. And and giving people tea and wrapping up, you know, their leg if they hurt themselves, whatever. Because we're in the middle of the woods. There wasn't even an electricity back then. And over the years, the festival changed, of course, and things evolved. But every year I went for 27 years. And so I had this very powerful influence in that way. And so I learned a lot about herbs then, and I became really, I've always been interested in spirit, and I've always had a spiritual path since I was basically a toddler, as Julia's age, outside looking for fairies under the pansies when I was 5. I knew they were there. So I've always had a calling to find spirit in my work. And so I studied witchcraft for a long time. And then that evolved into Celtic shamanism because it actually is what witchcraft is. Wicca is a very localizing Celtic form of shamanism. And so about 20 years ago, I opened that up into what other forms of world religions and mythologies can I study? Mm-hmm. And so I've always been doing that. And so Tibetan and Cherokee and, you know, just lots of different ancient ways of indigenous people doing healing work and magic and holding communities together. And, you know, the shamans were the healers in the villages, right? They were the midwives, and they were the ones who held counsel. And so that's been, you know, my calling as a healer for a long, long, since I have wanted to be doing this. And so that's all infused. And so mostly it's about, my passion is mostly about helping people to wake up to the beauty of their own personhood and what they really, this gorgeous gift they have and how to take care of it. Mm-hmm. Like how to wake up to that, how to take care of this. Because we're gifted with this magnificent, gorgeous four-element thing that we walk around in, right?
What do you mean a four-element thing?
I mean, we are water and we are earth, right? We are fire. Right? We are air. That's what we're made of. And when we're gone, when our spirit leaves, it all comes back to the earth, right? And so I think we forget that. I think we know it when we're young and we forget it. So my passion is how can I use any tool I can to help someone to wake up to that?
Mm-hmm. I'm just imagining someone walking into your office and you sharing this with them.
Well,
no, because no, I mean, because it takes time for, because I'm a marriage family therapist, right? And I sit with people all the time, and they don't get it.
No,
it takes time, and you, as a doctor, you don't have that much time in the office. I mean, I go to Kaiser, you know.
Yeah, you don't have minutes, right?
Time. It's like in and out.
I know. It's usually like that.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, you know, your words are beautiful, and I'm really moved and touched by. I would love you to be my doctor, but you know that can't happen. But, anyways, I'm just saying, you know. So what do you say to that? I mean,
well, I hope to have a long-term relationship with people and to have them not just do one-stop shopping once a year, which I tease them about. You know, like they come in with 11 things they want to, like, just get it over with and then move on. Like, where's the role of the doctor in our community any longer? You know, I'm not a pen to give them everything they think they should get from Google, right? That's not really the role, right? So the role is to be present and to sit with. And so people are often surprised when I'll say to them, just come back and see me. You can come whenever you want. You can come as often as you want.
Wow.
And they say, really? And I say, yeah, sure. Well, what if I don't have a problem? Like, I don't have a headache. I'm like, well, there's a reason you're coming to be here. You know, someone just came because they're leaving a difficult relationship. And I just said to her, come back and talk to me if you want. Maybe there's something I can share with you about this. And she did. And we spent, you know, I mean, it wasn't a long time. I said, I have to tell you, I have 20 minutes, not an hour. But bring it, you know, and I'll just give you a power surge of what I got.
Wow.
You know, and then if you want to come again, come in a different day.
Whenever there's an opening.
You know, like it's, you know, just, it's an invitation.
Wow. But do you give them like doctor stuff, or do you sit and listen like a therapist would do and just let them talk? I mean, what is it that you give this particular?
I feel like
example?
Sometimes I do spiritual counseling.
Uh huh.
Because in some ways I'm not a therapist, so I don't have to wait for them to tell me what the problem is and to fix it themselves, right? Like, how many times have you ever gone to a therapist and you're like, oh, please tell me what to do? You know, they don't. It's not
well,
good.
What do you
right?
think you should do?
Yeah. But the doctor prescribes, right? Mm. We're supposed to tell you. The thing is to learn how to turn it off when I go home or when I go in with my friends, right? Mm. It's to, like, not tell people, you know, this is what I would say. So, but I have permission. And I'll ask people, would you really like to hear what I think? Mm. You know, so it's a different relationship. Mm. So.
It seems like it may be more, and I'd say quicker and to the point, versus sitting around talking to a therapist for weeks and weeks and weeks. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is I do, I'm very also involved in nonviolent communication, Marshall Rosenberg's work. Uh-huh. This year I'm going to be being an assistant with the Santa Cruz group for nonviolent communication in starting in January. I'm really excited about that. And so I employ those tools. So offering empathy and support and listening and, you know, coming up with this is what it sounds like and this is what I'm hearing you say that you need and did I get that right? Those kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all the nonviolent communication.
It is.
Lingo.
Yeah. Did I get this right? And repeating after what you heard. And
it's
all
great
that, right?
though when people yeah. go, yeah.
Yeah. I know. People really don't listen.
Yeah.
They're so... They say something and then they're ready to move on and the person listening is ready to say what they need to say and they're ready to move on and they kind of miss each other sometimes.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that because the one thing I've been teaching now or advising is meditation. Mm. And almost everyone says, I can't meditate. Or they'll say, I can't sit still long enough. Or I can't make my mind be quiet. Or any blah, 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 blah. And so... You know, I really encourage people to start doing that with themselves, but also to find a teacher because it's so life-saving. Mm. So, as you both know, I just came back from, like, literally.
Oh, yes. Go ahead. Speak about that. Yeah.
Do we have time?
Well, I think this is a perfect time to maybe take our music break and then we've just given a snippet of what you're going to be talking about when we come back. So for the listeners out there, don't go away. Why don't you just say what you were going to say and then don't talk about it until after our music break. So say what you were going to say.
I literally today, this afternoon, 3 hours ago, came home from an 8-day silent retreat. So this is my first time talking.
You're doing a mighty fine job.
Mighty fine.
Thank you.
Okay. And you did bring along a piece of music that we'd like you to introduce and say why you brought it.
Well, you know, I have so many thousands of songs on my phone. And so when I heard you say, please choose that, I was like, oh, what came first? So this one came first. And I just love this song because it's so positive. That's why. I just love it.
What's the name of it?
What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful
world. Lovely.
What a beautiful song. Yeah. What a beautiful world, right?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that song and helping us remember.
Remember. Yes.
Remember.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you say that word, because we were just going to talk about Spirit Rock and my meditation retreat, right? Mm. And one of the things that we talked a lot about was remembering. Believe it or not, I didn't talk, but the teachers talked a lot about that we already have everything inside of us. Mm. We have all the love, and we have all of the knowing already inside. We just have to remember. And so when we're quiet and we can learn how this is my stormy mind up here and I'm down here looking at that, wow, it just allows spaciousness or room for something else to come in rather than this crazy tormenting we get from our thinking all day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what came in for you?
What came in for me? You know, I think that what came in for me is that life is really good, and that as I'm getting older, I think it's probably natural and a normal part of getting older to be aware that time is actually a quality to have to start thinking about. You know, when we're 35, I didn't think about time running out. Now I find myself recognizing that, gosh, this is like aging. Mm. You know, I think humans don't think they're going to age. Like other people age. Look at that old person, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, I think that's really becoming apparent as I'm taking one day after the next. Like, oh, wow, I'm getting older. So that's part of what came, mm-hmm. is just being with that. There's a beauty and there's a sadness and there's pain and suffering and awareness and acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Is this a common practice that you use, or is this one time, this first time ever being in a silent retreat?
It's a common, I do it every day. I meditate every day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking for 8 days.
Oh, I've done a couple of silent retreats for a long time, and I was initially afraid that I would miss talking, or that I'd feel like I had to talk, you know, or how does one not talk? But in truth, you're just talking in your head the whole time anyways, right? And then you're trying to make that stop, right? Mm. I think sometimes we talk just so we don't hear everything else that's going on in the head. So each time I've done a silent retreat, I haven't really wanted to come back to talking.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Where I realized that to be in the present moment is so important. You know, like that's what's really key, is not to be in the past and not to be in the future, but to be, because neither of those are real anymore. They're not real. You know, one is past and will never come back, and the other is just fantasy and what if. So to be in the present moment, and sometimes, you know, there's chatter talking that is unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And I can feel kind of impatient with that, which then I can look at that.
Always something to
look
at.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can just sit here and listen to you, Meg, because your voice is so soothing and I feel your love, you know, on this topic. But maybe we can get back into it later. But I'm curious about your coming out story, Cher, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I came out a long time ago. And
like how long ago?
1982.
How old were you?
I was, 27?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 27. Okay. Mm-hmm. 1982. I had a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. Well, they were 18 months. You know, they were all, you know. Yes. I had gone back to college, and after having children really young, I mean, I was 20 when I married a man, and I think that was an effort not to be gay. You know, I was expected to be normal, quote unquote, and I, you know, came from a family that was devoutly Catholic, and, you know, there wasn't anyone, I had never met a gay person that I knew. Mm. Any time it had ever been discussed, like, you know, the single teachers in the Catholic school and they had two women, they lived together, the second grade teacher and the third grade teacher. Well, now I think, well, they were probably lovers, but, you know, it was sort of forbidden. And it was sort of like, oh, you know, feeling like so sorry for them, like the adults would feel sorry for them that they weren't married and didn't have children. So there wasn't any place to just allow. I mean, when I look back now, I was recently at UC Berkeley, and I thought, oh, damn, you know, like, why didn't I just come out to California when I was 18, you know? I could have been here, you know? But then I thought, well, you wouldn't have your children now. You know, you just, now at this point in my life, you get to look back and look at all the choices you made, right?
Did you have any idea at a young age, though?
I did fall in love with my high school best friend, and I was madly in love with her, but she was in love with the kid across the street from me that I grew up with, who was a jerk. Mm. So, you know, drama. And I didn't understand it. Mm. So I suppressed it. You know, I didn't understand why I was jealous and why I just wanted to be with her all the time, you know? So, but I started figuring it out, and it was painful for my family. It was painful for my spouse, obviously. And, you know, his way of handling pain was to be retaliatory, and he sued me for custody. And that was in 1982 in Chicago. And so what's really great about this story is that we had a judge at that time, and maybe it's still like that today, but for every case, you were assigned one judge. So every time you went to court, you had the same judge. In other places in the world, you got a different person each time who just read the story and heard the story, and it was all kind of up for grabs. And so I had actually, I had two attorneys. At the time, I was working as a nurse. I was a nurse before I was a doctor. And I was working as a nurse, and I was working on an AIDS unit. And the I had ACT UP buttons and, you know, pink triangle button and stuff on my jacket. And they said, dress in a skirt and heels and pantyhose, take those buttons off. You know, you have to look really straight and narrow for the judge. It's like, I will do anything. I'll do anything. Okay. So I would sit on the aisle of the courtroom and I would cross my legs. You know, like stick my leg out in the aisle. Like, I'm a lady, you know, like I'm a regular person, you know, that whole thing. And then after some, what I want to say, forced mediation that didn't work for a long time, for almost a year, my ex-spouse would stomp out of mediation because he would get so frustrated and we just couldn't talk. I think he was just really scared for his children, and you know, I give him that now. But in any case, finally the judge called. He just called it one day and he said, you have been in mediation all this time. We have two employed, perfectly well parents. What is the real problem here? Mm. And he was this big man that I was a little afraid of. And I was certain he was a homophobe and, you know, he's a white man. And, you know, I was just scared. And my attorneys, in their very, very beautifully elegant, neutral way said, an expensive way, said, well, Your Honor, there's a difference in sexual orientation between the two parties. And the judge said, well, that does not happen in my courtroom, that will ever be an issue of parenting. Not in this courtroom. He said, you have 20 minutes to figure this out in the hallway, and then you come back in here.
Wow.
That's so
taking
empowering.
A stand. Wow.
That's so empowering.
Isn't that amazing?
What did you do or think in that moment when you heard him say those words?
I was stunned into joy. I was absolutely, I felt as if I was gifted from God. It was the most beautiful moment. And so we went out in the hallway and we agreed on what was then very popular, which was shared visitation, shared joint custody, where you make the decisions together as two parents, you know. So that's what we decided. But that court case actually set precedent for all the other cases in Illinois from that point forward, which was great. Yeah.
If somebody wanted to look up that court case,
they could. It was December 1982. It has a case name. I used to know it. I used to quote it. I don't have it in the file any longer.
Wow. But yeah. They could Google it or whatever.
Hopefully probably. They'll never need it.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that is just tremendous. Wow, what a powerful judge.
Yeah.
What a forward-thinking judge.
What did you say to him afterwards? Did you have any?
No. Oh, you don't get to talk to him.
No.
You just get to shake your leg at him, I guess.
Did you pull out your pins?
No, I didn't want to push it, you know. And so that was at a time when the Michigan Festival was beginning, and that's when I first started going, and the National Women's Music Festival was at Indiana University. It was very exciting times. Farron was just beginning to sing, and Holly Neer and Chris Williamson, you know.
Matt Christian.
Yeah, oh God, I was in love with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love her music, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah, let's not even talk about Meg Christian. Yeah.
Ode to a Gym Teacher.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite song.
Yeah, you did used to play that one, didn't you?
Yeah.
Wow.
How are you right now? You got this glow about
good.
You.
It's so nice that you want to know. Thank you for sharing, allowing me to share my story with you. Mm-hmm. It's been great. I think I also want to share with you, though, that, you know, it's been a struggle in medicine to come out as to be an out lesbian. I went to a Catholic medical school. All of my training in school since kindergarten has been Catholic. It just happened that way. And so there was a time, like I used to have, you know, I'd have a rainbow flag on my car, right? You know, back in the 80s and 90s, we just all did that, right? And it kept getting ripped off in the parking lot. Like things like that happened. Or there were 150 students and they were all about 12 to 15 years younger than I was. Because as I said, I started at 36 in med school and then an intern at 40. But I would notice like no one would sit in the aisle that I, there was an aisle of like five seats and then a, not an aisle, a row of five seats and then an aisle and then another row. And I would be in this aisle by myself, like strange, right? And so finally this young woman came and she sat next to me and she said, you know, none of the women want to sit next to you because they don't want to be thought of as a lesbian. I was like, wow, you're lost. Wow.
But that woman sat next to you. She took a risk or did she get up and leave?
She got up and left.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was very ostracizing.
I'm so sorry.
It was like God. That the whole time.
And they didn't know what a beautiful person you are were. And you're right. They're lost. But yeah. Still in that time, even though it's the past, mm-hmm. right? It. I'm sure it hurt so much.
It did, but you know, it was a time when it wasn't as accepted and easy, right? Mm. And so it was kind of the norm to be rejected. And, you know, but I had worked on an AIDS unit, the first designated HIV AIDS hospice unit in Chicago. And I did that for 4 years before I went into medical school. And, you know, like there, you know, you're just, I was like, patients of mine were in ACT UP and my son, Michael and I, you know, volunteered to protect and take care of the quilt when it was laid out in Washington. And some of those, quilt pieces are from patients of mine. It was a beautiful time and there was no time to mess around. Mm-hmm. You know, like I worked with four male nurses who all died of AIDS, my co-workers on that unit. You know, one day on Christmas Day, four people died on my shift. So, you know, at that point, you just know who your people are. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know where it's safe and you know where it's not safe. That's how it was. And so when I go to medical school, right, and you have some little upstart who doesn't want to sit with, I'm like, whatever. Do I want to know you? Not really. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, now I'm all about not being in separation and in being in unity and reaching across, you know. Mm-hmm. But that back then, it was a different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're more empowered now to maybe say something to somebody like that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say if that happened again?
I feel really sad hearing that. Mm. Gee. That's really sad. And then I would probably give some kind of a class presentation on LGBTQ to wake them all up. I actually did do something like that. I went to New Mexico for a month and I worked in HIV prevention there as part of a rotation for school. And when we went away for a month, we had to come back and give a presentation and it was all on harm reduction. So now we know about harm reduction, but that was back in the day when it began, right? So needle exchange and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I brought that back to all of them and I thought, well, let's have you think about this for a while.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm curious a little bit about you didn't have support back in medical school. I'm wondering how you had support or if you had support from your family or how that all happened.
After when you came out.
Yeah.
I'm curious about.
No, there was no support. Actually, I was disowned by a sister who still has not spoken. Well, I think she was forced to sit near me or with me at my son's wedding because my son insisted on inviting his aunt and then put her at my table, which at our table. But you know, to have normalcy around for the family. It was the first time I had seen her in over 20 years. And I leaned over and said, are you ready to be my sister again? And she said, yes. And I said, well, was it really the lesbian thing? Like, really? And she said, no, you were actually mom's favorite. And that's why I think it was really that I disowned you. But it's never gotten better. And so she and her spouse are fervent Catholics. And, you know, I my dad never understood. He, they're both gone. My mom and dad are gone. My mom never understood. Mm. And I think it scared them, and they just didn't understand. So no, it wasn't easy. Mm. Yeah.
Sorry to hear that. And just your sister? You only have one sib?
I have two sisters, and my other sister, I think she tried to understand. She went to festival with me once, of course, where it's, you know, 98% lesbian. And my sister came in, like, so cute. She came in, like, pink sweatpants, you know, and, like, just looked like such a straight girl, you know, to me. Like, I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody, but... And by the end of the week, she was wearing my clothes, and she came up from the kitchen, working in the kitchen, and she had, that woman is carrying her bag, and she's so nice. Isn't she nice? She carried my bag all the way up from the kitchen. I said, she's hitting on you. She goes, oh, stop that. I was like, no, she is. You're beautiful. She's hitting on you. She's like, she is not. And then she's like, really? Do you mean? I think she'd be really upset if she ever heard me tell that story, but...
Cute. So I know we talked a little bit, and you're interested in talking about diet and maybe offering some expertise to the audience or whoever listening to us. We would love some.
Okay. So this is what I tell all my patients.
I've got my pen. I'm taking notes.
No one should eat gluten. 0% tolerance. It's neurotoxic, meaning that it affects the brain and it causes inflammation in the body.
Even good gluten?
Even really good gluten. I know, it's terrible, but it's true.
How is it true? Is that research or this?
It's through research. I've done I've studied a lot. I've listened to a lot of people who make this their world, just talking about wheat and gluten and inflammation. So I studied functional medicine for a long time. The underlying understanding is that it's from inflammation that we get ill, right? We get joint pain and migraines and knee pain and belly pain. And and that when we take away those things that are food, that are irritants, that'll get better. And unfortunately, with the way that we farm and the way we do agriculture and then spray the wheat with Roundup before it's harvested, you know, this is what's happening. So people will often say, well, how come it doesn't happen in Europe? I can eat bread in France. And like, I wish I could eat bread in France, but haven't been there. But, and the point is that the agriculture is very different, very different. It's very old. It's an ancient form of way of doing farming. So the gluten is different.
What about organic white flour that hasn't been sprayed with Roundup?
Mm-mm. It has to be gluten-free. And I actually think that the wheat is so, it's like the first genetically modified product. So back in the early 1960s, President Johnson, if anybody is old enough to remember, created the war on poverty. Okay, it's one of the first wars, right, that they did for, you know, like some reason like that, and using those terms. And so they asked the scientists to put different wheat products together to make it denser and taller and bigger. And to produce more. And so that's when companies like Pillsbury and Betty Crocker and those kinds of companies became, you know, really big in terms of making the product, right? And so that's what is the problem, is genetically modified.
So what's another piece of advice besides no one should eat gluten?
Well, I won't actually, other than I would say that we have to be really mindful about dairy. You know, dairy coming from cows and cows eating, you know, hay, eating, you know, things they shouldn't eat like corn. So, you know, I'm nervous about, you know, what's going to happen around the kinds of food and how it's being produced and what we're eating. So the more whole, the more natural, certainly 100% organic only. That's better. And people often ask me also what supplements should they take, and I always say that we live in a part of the world where all of us are vitamin D deficient. There's not even a reason to bother to get the test. Just take vitamin D. If you live in the 44th parallel, which is one of the latitudes, or I think it's latitude, isn't it? That goes across. Yeah. Okay. Then you're vitamin D deficient.
And so taking a supplement like calcium with vitamin D, is that the same? I mean, would that work?
If you take enough vitamin D, so I usually say somewhere in the 2,000 to 4,000 units a day. And, you know, there's some controversy about taking calcium now, so I'd be careful about that. I also think that people should take fish oils or some version of, you know, omega-3 fatty acids, because it's so good for your brain. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's essential, and we aren't getting that from cold water fish any longer. So that's important. Mm. How's that?
That's good. Thank you. What about exercise? What would you say?
Oh, well.
Walking is good.
Walking is great. You know, I think, you know, humans were made to move. Mm-hmm. We were made to move our bodies. And if we don't move, we freeze. Mm. So we just have to move our joints. You know, you have to do something to move, whatever it is. And when people move, they feel better and they feel good and they feel embodied, you know, to be embodied. Because this is a beautiful, gorgeous, wise inhabitant we are in, right? It's this beautiful thing, so we need to move it. Absolutely. Every day.
I like that. Humans are made to move, otherwise we freeze. I like that, because it's true. Yeah, it's hard to move if you've been sitting for a while. It's like, get up, and it's like, so it's hard to be at the computer and not want to leave it, because you've got this project, you know?
Yeah, so it's not natural to be sedentary in a human. You know, we're not doing the outside farming anymore. We're not carrying water, chopping wood any longer so much, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we get all these aches and pains. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thank you so much for being our wonderful, fabulous guest this month.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Gold.
Yeah, with all that advice, we should leave you a tip or something.
Do you have... for anyone listening, like non-medical advice about being gay in this world these days?
LGBTQ.
LGBTQI. Plus. Or, you know, something along those lines to help folks who might be listening?
Well, you know, it's really scary times when you hear news like we just heard before we started this program, and we hear about someone who was killed that's transgender. I mean, that's, you know, really stunning to the heart, right? And we carry that with us, a certain level of fear, but it's so important to be who you are. Mm. It's so important to be strong, and it's important to find each other and to be unified and to be a fighting force. But a presence, just to be who you are. Wasn't it Oscar Wilde who said, just be you, everyone else is already taken?
Yeah, right.
Right?
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah. You have to stand up and be who you are.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. It's time for us to leave, and just wanted to let everyone know that just like Dr. Gold, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can support others in being free and living their lives authentically. It's another way to help the world. Give us a call. Like them, you too can be visible and vibrant in telling your story. And this is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
Support for Outbeat Radio and KRCBFM comes from members and from Sonoma West Publishers, bringing you the Sonoma West Times and News, the Healdsburg Tribune, the Cloverdale Reveille, and the Windsor Times, providing independent journalism and local community conversations in print and online at sonomawest.com. Be sure to turn in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio 91. You're listening to 91.1 KRCB FM Windsor and 90.9 K215 CQ Santa Rosa. Online, on the air, or on the go. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Open Space District is next. Some man.